Live? Okay.
Okay, Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Monday, March 23rd, 2015 will come to order. And our first bill is held over from the last committee hearing that we had, Senator Hurt, Senate File 282. Thanks for your patience in waiting until today, Senator.
Yeah, it's been a long wait, whole weekend. Let's hope we can get this bill passed along so quickly. And if you testify with me here too, you know.
Okay. All right.
And a little over two years ago, you know, I had the privilege of door knocking homes, and I'm sure many of you did that too, door knocking homes across my district. I came across so many vacant homes. Almost every block has a vacant homes and has a foreclosed home. So, you know, that prompted me to work harder, you know, and I did mention before that a number of my shoes that I walk on was torn. So, you know, I worked very hard to get here so I can make some change to our policy that could try to reduce the home disparity.
You'll have to go down to Senator Schmidt's district and buy some Red Wing shoes.
So last year I worked with Micah and many of the partners, you know, on the Housing Opportunities Make Equitable, or abbreviated as HOME, and we successfully passed that legislation with 57-0. The bills before you is Senate File 282, and it asks for $1 million investment into the home law to provide the development of more homes across the state, provide intensive home ownership and family stability training, and provide additional financing tool for home ownership for low incomes and community of colors to help reduce our housing disparity. I have here is Sue Phillip and David McGee and Chris Byrne, also Ruby Lee, right, as well. So they're here to testify and also going to provide you answer to some of your questions.
Okay, who wants to go first? Just say your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, MICA, and President and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the $100 million investment into the home law, which we passed last year, Senate File 282. As people of faith, we believe that we are to love others and treat others the way that we treat ourselves. And that means that everyone, without exception, should have a decent, safe, and accessible and affordable home, both rental and home ownership. Now, home ownership is our primary form of workforce housing across the state of Minnesota, with us having well over 70% of Minnesota households in home ownership. Besides living in the metro area half of my life, I live in Itasca County half of my life, and I've invested in homes up there and helped to place many of our people to live in communities in home ownership as they work at our local store and at a resort that I also help to manage. So I speak from both a urban perspective as well as a greater Minnesota perspective. My dad grew up on a farm in Underwood, Minnesota, so very much familiar with our entire state.
Senator Saxon.
Ms. Lee,
this is Ms. Phillips.
Ms. Phillips, what resort is that on?
It's Island View Resort.
Oh,
it's up
yeah.
on Sand Lake.
Yeah,
yes.
It is.
Yes. Hey, I'm sure you're familiar with it, sir.
I am. Thank you.
Yes. The Housing Opportunities Made Equitable, the home law, was passed in 2014 and provides additional opportunities to expand home ownership to more of our families of color, Hispanic, Latino, and American Indians throughout Minnesota. We want to thank Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for already investing $21.3 million. And if you had a chance to look at the packet that you received last week, you can see on the back of this first page is a list of all the organizations around the state that have already received these dollars, and they're using them quite quickly. And we expect the entire $21.3 million to be used by this summer. The home law is an outgrowth of the excellent model that David McGee will talk about more in just a few minutes from Build Wealth, and brought to MICA from the African American Leadership Forum as we began to talk about developing legislation a couple years ago to address the disparity in home ownership. Last year, we were the worst in the country in disparity between white and non-white home ownership, In 2015, we are now the third worst. Vermont is worse, and South Dakota is worse. But we're just incrementally making some change with all the good work of people around this room. The home bill basically allows us to develop and rehab homes. Right now, we have almost 250,000 vacant units across the state of Minnesota. So in addition to the great apartment units and rental units of housing that we heard last Wednesday, we want to make sure that we have home ownership, especially in very small communities in greater Minnesota that just really don't have the need for the larger capacity of a large apartment building. But we do have vacant homes throughout our greater Minnesota, as well as a lot of vacant units, as Senator Hur said, as he went door knocking in each neighborhood that he door knocked. It provides intense family stabilization and home ownership training, and provides additional financing tools to Minnesota Housing Agency with a funding priority given to culturally based organizations to operate these programs. The $100 million into the home law has broad-based support, and hopefully you had an opportunity to see the number of organizations that are part of this, as well as the 75 organizations and congregations that are part of MICA that have been supporting it, and you have a little bit of history. It passed, as Senator Hur said, 57-0 here in the Senate, and 130-0 in the House last year. Governor Dayton signed it on National Day of Prayer, May 1st last year, which we thought was very appropriate because there were a lot of people praying for this bill around the state and around the country. We were disappointed, though, that the governor did not include this in his supplemental budget. And we hope that you will add additional dollars so we can continue the great work that's already happening around the state. As you can see on this page, our state is becoming much more diverse, yet our home ownership rate for our people of color, Latino, Hispanic, and American Indians, is lower now than it was in the 1960s. And so we were at almost 50% home ownership rate for people of color in 1960, and now we're at 39%. So we have a situation that we're not going the right way in helping more and more of our folks that are moving throughout our state get into home ownership.
Does that have something to do with the increase in the population, though?
That has something to do with the increase in the population, but also that we are our current way that we've been providing home ownership opportunities is not getting as many people of color into home ownership. Now, the Minneapolis Federal Reserve took a look.
Why don't you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Oh, sure.
Go ahead. The last thing you said.
Okay. I think if you take a look at this next page, which I'm just getting into right now, it's a fact sheet. And on the bottom here, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, there's a little graph here. If you can see that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you can see on our first-time home mortgage loans, in fiscal year 2015, we will do $400 million. Okay? Only 23% of those loans that they're estimating right now will probably go to people of color. Now, last year, Minnesota Housing exceeded that expectation. We expect that they're going to exceed that expectation because of the great work that people are doing already through the home law activities that Minnesota Housing's been funding. So we're seeing that more people are becoming eligible for our first-time home buyers, but we want more and more folks to be able to get into that program. So, Mr. Chair, the Minneapolis Federal Reserve took a look at what would it take for us to just address 10% of the disparity, just 10% of the disparity of people of color, Hispanic, Latino, and American Indians. What that would mean is 16,600 plus folks, and I'll give you the exact number, 16,655 households would have to become homeowners this year. 16,000 new homeowners this year. For us to do that, we would have to invest over $2 billion, not million, not hundreds of million, $2 billion just to deal with 10% of the disparity. This bill is asking for a $100 million investment. Both the Minneapolis Federal Reserve and the Met Council research shows that not addressing this disparity is hurting us to grow in our economy and is hurting us in growing in our personal wealth. The Met Council indicates that if we don't address disparities in the Twin Cities area, we will only grow by personal wealth about $15 billion. If we address all the disparities, including home ownership, we will grow by $31.8 billion between now and 2040. The National Home Builders Association indicates that there's a significant return for job growth, and David will talk more about that. And the University of Minnesota shows that for every dollar that we put into this longer-term Home Ownership Family Stabilization Program, there is a $12 return. People getting off public assistance, getting into better jobs, stabilizing their families. So as a result of this investment, families will know the stability by being a well-prepared homeowner and increase their assets. Neighbors and communities will stabilize and increase their tax base as we use some of those foreclosed and vacant homes. They're purchased and new homes are built on some of our vacant lots in our communities. And then the other great thing about this bill is that as people move into home ownership, and some of our larger families are renting currently 2 and 3 apartments, as they move into home ownership, we're opening up apartments for folks to move into that we desperately need in the community. The time is now to pass Senate File 282. It's not only a moral imperative, but it's an essential investment for the well-being of our residents, business, and economic growth of our state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Who wants to go next?
I'll go next.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to testify today. And I also want to thank those senators that voted 57-0 last year to make the home bill actually a law last year. Today, I also want to thank Minnesota Housing, because Minnesota Housing has been extremely supportive of this longer-term family stabilization model. They've been funding my organization. My name is David McGee, and I'm the executive director of Build Wealth Minnesota. And Minnesota Housing has been funding us for 7 years in providing a longer-term approach of helping families get into sustainable home ownership. And out of the last 7 years, it's a program that provides long-term education for up to 2 years and one-on-one counseling for families, primarily families of color, to break some of the barriers of poverty and barriers to get into sustainable home ownership. Over the last 7 years, we've had zero defaults out of any of the loans for the families that have gone through the long-term education program that Minnesota Housing has been funding. They also have been providing some really great down payment assistance alignment with this program as well. We are also very thankful for Minnesota Housing and the commissioner and its team for funding two programs that are aligned with this home bill today. The Enhanced Financial Capacity Program is a program that they started funding $650,000 to 7 organizations around the state that are doing this longer-term approach. It's a very heavy-lifting, very costly approach to doing it, but the returns are so great. And so we thank Minnesota Housing for starting that, really based on what they had already been funding for the prior 7 years. Now we're looking for that to expand throughout the state. Minnesota Housing also started a targeted mortgage pool, a targeted mortgage opportunity pool, that loans could be made to folks that still fit Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and FHA guidelines, but would be able to tackle some of those things where a number of these families have gotten into some predatory practices early on, and different barriers have stopped a lot of these people of color from getting into home ownership. So the long-term education aligned with an affordable targeted mortgage pool has been very successful to date. Thus far, they've put money in, and I think more than 60% of the money has been deployed already. And as Sue Watler-Phillip has testified, most of that money will be gone by the end of this year. I did want to talk about, and there was a sheet that was handed out that talked about the Housing Opportunities Made Equitable Home Bill, and as I picture of the state capitol in the middle of the state. I did want to talk about this as not being a handout. We're not looking for a one-time handout for a bunch of people of color to get into some type of entitlement program. We're looking for the home bill to be an investment with an awesome return that's justified by some facts that are on this sheet. The first portion is that we're looking for up to 400 units of housing to be built, because we're finding that a lot of the housing stock is either aged, is too small, and a lot of the families don't fit in the existing inventory. And so we know there's some programs, the Challenge Fund and some other programs that have been made available to do some of this building. However, most of these programs don't have enough funding to date. So we're looking for $60 million to build 400 homes over the next 2 years. And as you can see from the sheet, this is not just a handout. There's actually a return of approximately $110,000 in tax revenue and other state revenue with the building of each one of these homes. In addition to that, there's 2.97 jobs that will be created with each one of these units being built. As you can see, it will return the state $44,328,800 by making an investment of the $60 million to build houses. The second item on the list talks about this new enhanced financial capacity program and investing in the lives of people that begin to build their credit, build their ability to save and budget and become gainfully employed. And part of this program, we're asking for $16 million over the next 2 years. And the University of Minnesota, as in your packet as well, has done, CURA, the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs, has done a study on this particular model in 2010. And they're also doing a new study this year where the numbers are looking even better. There's a $12 to every $1 invested return on a program like this. So by the state investing another $16 million in this type of long-term programming has the ability to bring the state back $192 million back to the state on a $16 million investment. And the last item that I'd like to talk about as it relates to an investment, part of the targeted mortgage pool that Minnesota was so graciously, and I'd have to say, took a lot of courage to actually create a loan fund that was targeted at people of color in the environment that we've been in. Right now, as you can know, compliance and all the different things have made credit very hard to get for a lot of people. And so by creating this loan pool, we've been able to get a number of people in homes already. I think there's 40 families that have already been able to get this money thus far. We have zero defaults, zero lates thus far. And I just wanted to make a note that by investing this type of money, we're not looking for a handout or a grant. We're looking for an investment. And in working with the CFO of Minnesota Housing, we did an analysis on what kind of revenue could be generated to go back into this type of long-term education. And just in a pool of this particular pool, we could bring $11,755,000 back into the state. So we're asking that you move this forward in hopes of taking this law and adding these appropriations to bring $248 million back to the state with this $100 million investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. Any questions? Mr. McGee, just out of curiosity, on the building of the 400 homes statewide and the 2.97 jobs, are the 2.97 jobs the people building the homes, or are they new jobs for the people who move into the homes?
That would be the people building the homes.
Okay. All right. And what do you attribute the zero default rate to?
I believe it's the education, it's the long-term approach of education. We're not just doing we've got a home stretch in our state, which is an eight-hour training, it's required. But I believe it's the longer-term approach. Most of the organizations that are doing the longer-term approach are giving folks 24 to 36 hours of classroom hours. Then there's the one-on-one counseling, there's peer learning. And we're doing it in a way where it's by people that look like the people that are going through the challenges a lot of the time. And we're opening up opportunities to have an applied learning practice where they're applying the principles from week to week as they're learning them, as they're starting to grow, and they're breaking some of the old behaviors and some of the old patterns that a lot of them have gotten in from being impoverished for so long. There's so many systems of racism and systems that have kept a lot of people back. And so now here's a way to get people to be productive citizens by encouraging them and teaching them the intricate details of the systems of credit and housing, insurance, and how these things affect our families. And I believe that this approach is opening up the eyes and giving a paradigm shift to the families that are going through this process. Then they're linked up with coaches that can actually counsel those families along the way of what being a successful homeowner is all about. So it isn't just about the house, it's about the home. and most of these programs, and I'm sure that Ruba Lee will be speaking about it, it brings about home, a different kind of approach of wealth for not just the family, but for the community and ultimately the state.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Westbrook.
Mr. Chair, a little related to that zero default, how many loans are we talking over that period of 7 years? And is there some emergency fund or other things in place that help cover somebody that might be close to default?
There's about 300 families that have gone through the process and gone in and have zero defaults. There are a number, with this coaching piece and the alignment with other community partners, there are a number of resources that are there to help the folks in case that they're falling, you know, they may fall into some troubled times. Most of the programs with the one-on-one coaching allows families to be re-underwritten, so to speak, and there's a consistent tracking of the family. So it isn't like they just get a certificate and they walk away. There's a hand-holding process that keeps these families on track to make sure that they have workable, mendable budgets. And if there are opportunities where they fall in, there are a number of different resources that we align them up with a number of community partners.
So, Mr. Chair, what would those resources be? I mean, are they other state funds that kick in so the default rate stays at zero, but maybe there's some other fund that's picking up the bill?
Well, most of it is more educational than it is additional resources being actually put in. Once they bought a house, there's not like you can go out and get additional dollars to help them in that case. I believe that the education is the thing that's putting them on track, that's keeping them from going into default. I don't believe it's pouring more money in or good money after bad. I Very think good. That the effective training and the hand-holding, the coaching is the thing that's keeping these guys focused and keeping them to be better stewards over their money. And they're starting to save. Even with the targeted mortgage pool, families have to have 3 months reserve. So there was a season back in 2007. We all know about the crash. There were a number of people that were getting into housing prematurely. They didn't have money in the bank. They didn't have some of the resources and some of the education. There are a lot of different credit tools that were getting them in harm's way, and I think that these programs are getting them educated to avoid such products.
And, Mr. Chair, you kind of went where I was going with my next questions, but to flush that out a little bit more, how do you determine who can do it and is eligible, in the sense that I assume they got to have a steady income? And you mentioned 3 months, 3 months reserve. What other things do they look at? And you mentioned the housing stock out there is older houses and stuff, and doesn't match what people are looking for. Do you line up? I mean, sometimes those houses are first good opportunities for first homes for people to put a little time and effort into. Maybe it's not ideal. How do you evaluate that? And you also mentioned new houses on bare lots, and how do you evaluate that as well? And the reason I ask is, getting into new construction housing is oftentimes not a winning situation, especially if cash flow is already tight, because the cost of building new is probably going to use up all the equity in your house, if you even have equity left when you're done building it. And so I'm just curious, how do you kind of evaluate that and fit different people into different options, or does everybody get the same option once they're in?
No, everybody is going to be different. We're using traditional underwriting standards, and so we're still not trying to create a product, as I said, that's an entitlement program. Everyone still has to qualify under normal circumstances. So they're still going to have a strong employment history. They're still going to have a strong credit history. What we've been finding, that there have been some credit challenges that were caused beyond their control because of different barriers that I spoke about earlier. They're still going to need reserves, and they're still going to have to go through the same processes of qualifying as if they went to a traditional lender.
Sure. For
that particular portion. You spoke about, or your question regarding the existing inventory. Right now, we're getting folks in as they're able to find properties, as the Right now, it's a seller's market, and so for the most part, we're running into a situation that those available houses that would have been available as affordable units for a lot of families, once they hit the market, they're gone in next to 2 weeks a lot of times. And so what we're finding is in certain neighborhoods, some of the aging stock that's in those neighborhoods is obsolete for some of the larger families. And we're finding that all around the state, as this is a statewide effort and a statewide act, that a lot of locations around the state, and there should be some information in your packet that talks about some of the communities don't have the sizes of properties that would fit some of these growing families that are building in some of these communities. A lot of immigrant communities are starting to go into Rochester and some Mankato and St. Cloud and some of these other areas. These are usually larger families, and the existing inventory doesn't always match that. So putting a family of 7, 8, 9, or 10 in a 2 or 3 bedroom property that's now obsolete brings a whole nother set of circumstances for that particular family, and stress and strain of being overcrowded. And this, I don't know about you, it's hard to get in the bathroom in the morning sometimes at my house. And you put a family of 7, a couple young ladies and a wife fighting for the bathroom, and you're a gentleman in the house, it could get very stressful in that house.
Thank you for your answer.
You're welcome.
I feel your pain. Who wants to go? Oh, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As it relates to the education and coaching, who all gets to qualify? I assume there are people outside of those who acquire homes through this program that qualify for that. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
Okay. And so how do they come into the picture?
Well, a lot of them are coming through what we call community access points for the most part. So we're linked to like 38 churches and probably 15 organizations around the community where they have actually sent people to our organization. And word of mouth right now, 50% of the families that are coming into these programs are by referral. They're finding out that there's a better mousetrap, so to speak, that's helping families to get from one place to another. And so we're not turning away anyone. So at this point, we're taking a number of people and then putting them through the process of those that are capable of being homeowners. And everyone isn't meant to be a homeowner, but really going through and vetting out the process of who is and when they're ready. The program is up to 2 years, so we've got a lot of people that aren't ready month 1 through 9. However, they're able to begin to start getting their family ready over the next 6 to 7 months. And so this is a very expensive model, but it's a very effective model.
Mr. Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many, Mr. McGee, how many families would you say are enrolled in this program right now?
With our organization alone, we have over 1,000 families that are in at one given time overlapping. And right now, we have 7 organizations that have received the proceeds out of here. And as my understanding, it's about 700 so far. But there are a number of other organizations around the state that weren't so successful in this competitive round to get financing. And so we believe there's about 25 organizations around the state, as we're hoping that with funding like this, we could actually see about 16,000 households touch this programming with this additional funding.
Thank you.
Thank you. Who wants to go next? Go
ahead. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Chris Barden. I'm here to speak in support of the $100 million investment into Housing Opportunities Made Equitable Law. The Build Wealth Family Stabilization Program helped my family purchase a beautiful home, as you can see in the packet that you guys have. I'm currently 29. I'm married. I have a son and a beautiful daughter that just got into the picture about a year ago, so she's about 14 months old now. My wife and I both dreamed about purchasing a home and owning a home at one point in time, and we struggled. We struggled with budgeting, struggled with the house, the intricacies of getting to that end result, right? The end result of owning that home. Yeah, current time, I was working for Wells Fargo. I still currently work for Wells Fargo. Current time, before purchasing a home, I was making about $40,000 a year. Renting a decent place, more of a one-bedroom for three people, which is me and my wife and my son. It was about $800 a rent for a one-bedroom. Pretty crowded, pretty stuffed, just because it was a one-bedroom. But we wanted to try to get to our end result, which was purchasing a home, right? So that's kind of the route that we decided to take at the time. We became involved with the intensive family stabilization, home ownership training. My wife and I both began to learn some of those, that process of getting to become a homeowner. We went through the training. It helped us kind of the right hand speak to the left hand, in a sense. So we were on the same page with finances, same page with budgeting factors. And it wasn't just me trying to wiggle through and making sure that our family is staying afloat, which helped tremendously. Now, current day, we own a home. We've been in our house for 4 years now. So like David McGee had mentioned, we had currently that we're in no default. We're current with all our payments. And currently I believe that it's just been being able to reach our ultimate goal within the program. It's became a very stable place for my family and I. It's an increasing asset. A home, I see it as an asset, for me and my family. Great place to raise a family, it's been a great neighborhood. Now, through the years, I've been able to also increase in employment. So I still work for Wells Fargo. I make $56,000 a year now. So, you know, that home has now been, we've been able to now kind of gain in the sense of now being able to save more because we aligned our budget to meet the initial requirement of being able to budget into that home and sustain it. So now our budget of saving has been able to increase because of over time being able to increase in income. I just kind of want to thank the program and also thank you guys for allowing me to testify in support of the funding of the investment that hopefully we'll be passing into law.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Good story. So were you kind of like not budgeting before, or did you not know how to, I mean, what specifically did the program do to help you get to the point where you're at?
So I'm a big, I took care of all the finances in the household. My wife was more like, hey, you're good with that stuff, take care of it. So it was hard because we were never on the same page. So she didn't really know, you know, what we truly had as our intake and outtake. So when I tried to budget, you know, and have money aside for our end goal or just savings in general, you know, she would kind of do a little bit more spending than it should be and things like that. And it didn't work out because she didn't really understand the picture as far as what our finances truly were. And then the program.
She's not here today, right?
No, she's not. She's not. But, you know, as I know, you know, the good old saying, a happy wife, happy life, right? But I really decided to take the approach where if we both knew the same mythology, we were all under the same page as far as what our intake and outtake was, then we would, our ultimate end goal would be very successful. And the program really taught us that. It taught us how to communicate and how to see those numbers in an interesting factor, I guess you could say, not just in the numbers piece of it. So, you know, just to kind of give a brief example, we were able to kind of think of a pie chart and separate that. Our budgeting was we try to live off of 60% of our income and then divvy out the rest of it, which was, you know, we're big givers to our church, so 10% went to giving. You know, we paid ourselves our 10% in a sense. And, you know, we kind of divvied that out. Well, now we've been successfully been able to kind of now live off of 50% of our income and increase in other aspects and, you know, and put in an emergency fund and things like that. And seeing it that way with her through the program made it more interesting. And right on board. So, you know, today, current day, she loves looking at that chart and saying, hey, can we increase this 10% to pay ourselves? Can we do this to 15? So it kind of makes it a little bit more interactive and a fun way to look at numbers in a sense.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Ruby Lee. I'm president of CLUES. CLUES stands for Latino Communities United in Service. Our agency has been in existence for over 35 years. We serve communities, specifically Latino and New Americans, in both the metropolitan, both Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and some minor services in the greater Minnesota area. I'm here today not only as president of CLUES, but also to tell you a little bit about my own story. I have worked in philanthropy for the last, before coming to CLUES, I worked in philanthropy for the last 18 years. Part of my work was working with private foundations in helping to reduce racism, helping to reduce poverty. As we look at poverty, one of the best learnings that we had was that certainly building assets was the fastest vehicle to help get communities out of poverty. And obviously, buying a home was one of the first steps to get into asset building. At CLUES, our work is delivered in a family-centric model. We have been highlighted by the Kellogg Foundation and the Aspen Institute as one of the largest organizations in the country that focuses on lifting two generations at once. What that means for us is working with parents and their children in building healthy and stable homes for them to thrive socially, emotionally, educationally, and financially. As we all know, Minnesota has many things to celebrate in terms of how well we're doing in per capita home ownership, how well we're doing in employment, and how well we're doing in lower poverty rates for white communities. On the other hand, the story for people of color is very different. I have a handout that I sent out, I hope you received it, that highlights how we're rating in Minnesota. While 6% of white people live in poverty in the metropolitan area, 25% of people of color and American Indians live in poverty in the metropolitan area. While we have been number one in per capita home ownership, people of color rate as the third worst in the country. We have one of the largest racial poverty gaps in the nation today. To share a little bit about my own personal story regarding home ownership, when I came to Minnesota 35 years ago, I wanted to purchase my first home. I married somebody from Minnesota, and at the age of 24, I was ready to buy my first home. When I tried to do that, I was told that I couldn't. I had a down payment. I had a stable job with the state of Minnesota. My husband was also employed, and yet I was told that I couldn't buy a home. I could not understand why not. At that time, I began to understand the financial system in the United States. I was told that I had no credit built. And so when I found out, I was raised in a household where my mother always taught us that if you don't owe money, that's good credit. You live within your means. You don't owe money. You don't borrow money. When you come to this country, you realize that the system is very different than the one that you had. So it took for somebody at that time from Minnesota Housing to help me understand what I needed to do. I needed to apply for a credit card. I needed to go borrow money from, or borrow services, I guess, from a store. And I will not forget that it was Sears who gave me my first credit card because at that time, Dayton's and other stores denied me. I had no credit built in this country. So it took for somebody to help me. To help me understand why and how to do it. And therefore, I began to build my credit. My husband did too. And then it took us, a year or so to get in line to purchase our first home. What we do at CLUES is we provide bilingual, bicultural services. We work on a family-centric model, as you were saying earlier. It takes the family to understand both husband and wife, and the children included. Our services work on eliminating barriers, providing opportunities for families. We work on one-on-one financial coaching with our clients. We have consumer education practices that help people learn about their choices so that they prevent, getting involved with predatory lenders. We work on anything and everything that has to do with home ownership and also with foreclosure prevention. The demand for services at our organization today are huge, particularly in the greater Minnesota area. We do not have the capacity financially to have services out there. So that what we try to do is to mix some of the work that we do in outreach in greater Minnesota, particularly Mankato, Rochester, and other areas, and then work with local cities and local towns so that they can promote the session that we will be doing in these communities. we provide the home stretch program, and we provide other programs that are really at capacity. We try to limit it to 35 people, and we have waiting lists today. So I am here to support Senate File 282. And I believe that the funding for this will help us not only look at the bricks and mortar part of successful home ownership, but also the support and the coaching that our families need to not only purchase a home, but also stay in their home once they buy it. The bill also talks about wraparound support services, which is the services that we provide at CLUS. I stand ready for any questions.
Okay, thank you. All right, are there any questions or comments of either the author or any of the testifiers? Okay, thank you all very much then. And I think we have one more. Jean Lee wants to say something. Welcome, Ms. Lee. Just say your name for the record, and then you can go ahead and testify.
Members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and APAC, the Housing Consortium. There are some handouts that have been passed out to you. I don't know if you received it. You could just go over that. I want to thank Senator Fong-Hur and Representative Clark, who does the House side, legislators, Micah, and others involved in the Senate File 282, House File 997, as a solution to removing barriers in addressing the unmet needs of ethnic communities and organizations. I'm a former Fortune 500 corporate auditor who switched to helping Minnesota's unserved and underserved population in areas of need through improving system responses, direct services, and other activities. My experience is in various areas of housing and development for over 50 years. I've also done legal advocacy, public policy, social service, and victim services for over 28 years. And I've helped a number in, specifically, I work with the Asian Pacific community and organizations. But even with my years of experience, my degrees, and all my licenses, I still have to have certifications in housing that for years wasn't required. And I do have the most housing certifications than any other Asian Pacific organization. And I still face barriers in accessing Minnesota Housing Finance Agency housing programs and funds. So these other organizations are having even a harder time. Now, the home law, I feel, opens the doors for some of these ethnic organizations who are serving the communities. However, only one got through. To better serve the community and the other ethnic organizations, there needs to be more access. And this is what we're encouraging legislators to consider as far as the flexibility in the funding so that the other organizations could also have access. These would include the emerging HUD-approved organizations, because HUD goes through a certain process. So even my organization is considered an emerging HUD because we do not have the final say-so yet. But we have met a number of other criterias. And then there's organizations that have what they call their established organizations, but they are starting up with their housing programs. So they are also in that group that's being left out. And so we ask for some flexibility here. And we're hoping that, you know, this the funding, which was supposed to address this, also looks at how the needs need to be further met. So we do ask that you support this bill towards serving the unserved and underserved populations and the non-Asian nonprofit organizations serving them. And as far as the other testifiers, they've given you all the stats on it, so I don't need to say further of how this would help reduce the disparities in the housing area where we're third worst in the nation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hur, anything further?
Mr. Chair, I ask that this bill be layover for possible inclusion.
Okay. Are there any further questions, Senator Wilson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hurd, just can you explain, and maybe you did in the beginning and I missed right at the very beginning, but the money's allocated, but what does it go to, just classes and training, or does it buy down some interest rates or other things, or how does the money generally get used?
Senator Westrom, I'd like to defer to Ms. Phillips here to answer you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, currently the $21.3 million that the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has taken out of their own budget, $20 million of that is going towards financing, and $1.3 million is going towards the home ownership training. In this piece of legislation for the $100 million, $60 million would go towards either rehabbing or building housing on the lots that we've been talking about throughout our state. Another $16 million would go towards the longer-term home ownership training family stabilization program for 25 organizations statewide. And then the remainder of the money, the $24 million, would go into the more flexible financing for those that may not qualify currently for the first-time home buyer, but do have the ability to handle a mortgage.
Mr. Chair, So the $60 million and the $24 million. Talk to me about the flexible mortgage. What is that money used for? Do they buy interest rates down so it's 1% or 2% interest? Does it pay the down payment and they pay the other 80% of the loan, in essence a grant? How does that work? And then the $60 million, if you're building houses, is it like Habitat for Humanity funding projects and that people pay back a certain mortgage? Are you having prisoners build houses at a reduced price and the buyers or the homeowners are still buying them and paying that back to you, or is it an outright grant to those home buyers?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm going to have David McGee come back up again for a minute too. Basically, on the financing piece, what we're trying to do is provide a little bit more flexibility. For example, if one of your children, after going to college, comes out with $100,000 in student loans, they're not going to be eligible for a first-time home buyer because they just will not be eligible with that type of debt. So what we're trying to do is recognize that how things have changed in our society and the expense of doing further education is getting in the way of some people becoming homeowners. That's one example. Certainly our Muslim friends and other folks of different faiths do not do interest. So we're trying to figure out ways that people can get into home ownership opportunities that don't necessarily fit with the typical way that we do financing right now. I'll turn it back over to David to talk a little bit about the building of the housing. Habitat for Humanity is one of the organizations that is getting a part of that first $10 million that was allocated. I believe they probably already have gotten more than the $2.5 million. David Build Wealth has gotten $3 million, and I think already received another $3 million of that, and I'll let him talk about how those dollars are used.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the loans are actually traditionally amortized loans. They're not grants. They're paid just like any loan. They don't do have buy downs. Any quirky features like balloons or adjustable rates. It's a standard fixed rate product. These particular loans don't have, as with an FHA product, they're backed or guaranteed with a mortgage insurance premium. These particular loans don't have a mortgage insurance premium. When Minnesota Housing initiated this loan pool, they put a set aside initially of 20%. So the first $10 million in the loan pool, $8 million went to the loans, and $2 million or 20% of the $10 million was set aside as a loan loss reserve. Typical coverage that would be for a traditional loan products anywhere from 6% coverage to about 18% coverage. So they actually put a risk component in here. So they mitigated the risk by putting additional monies aside for that. But it is a traditional mortgage that's being amortized like any other product that's there.
So Mr. Chair, David, on so the $60 million, let's just say $200,000 of that's going to build the house. You're turning around and then you're the bank, i.e. the financing for that home buyer, homeowner, who then turns around and pays the $200,000 back with some interest, and those are the payments that you guys have had no default on. And that money goes where? Am I following that path?
No, I think that with the building of the house, you're still going to we're still trying to get traditional lenders to try to help us in this effort as well. And so we're looking for folks that when we build the houses, they're going to have to get either a traditional mortgage, qualify for some of the community lending that's there through like U.S. Bank has an American Dream program. Bremer Mortgage has a gateway product. They'll be able to, because of the limited resources in this targeted pool, only some people will qualify for that particular pool of resources. So the goal isn't to build a house to give them away. A goal is to build a house so that there be additional affordable housing in those areas, in those communities.
So, and that's where I'm having a disconnect, Mr. Chair. So the $60 million we talked about is going to build houses. What specifically will those dollars be used for if traditional financing is used to buy the house?
To build the house. Right now, I don't see any builders that are lining up to build affordable housing and making an investment of that type to close the disparity gaps in the state. So we're asking for the state to make that investment and be prepared to reap the benefits of the sale of the homes.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, so we would put the houses up and wait for the buyers to come, who then would have traditional, you'd work with them for bank financing. They would turn around and buy the house, and the state would then get paid back for that purchase?
Yes.
And the money would be back, or would it be in a loan pool at that point where they would use the money again?
It is our hopes it would be a combination of the loan pool, and they would be families that would go through this longer-term approach. And so we know that some of these houses are going to cost quite a bit more and going to require us to get subsidies and possibly some market tax credits and different things to build these larger homes and these different homes and renovate these homes.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, and to that point, are we selling them for market value, or where does the affordable housing come in? Because I mean, to build a big house is $120 a square foot nowadays, I would guess, give or take. And if you build even a 2,000 square foot home with 4, 5, 6 bedrooms, it'd be pretty small for that many bedrooms, but doable. That's still $225,000 or $250,000. And if you build a 3,000 square foot house, you're probably at $375,000. How are they going to buy that house for $375 and pay $75,000 and pay the government back, or what am I missing?
As part of this structure, similar to other housing products, it's our hopes that we're able to attract other new markets tax credits and different types of subsidies that can help us build some of these products as part of the 400 units. Our goal also is to buy existing products that are houses that are out there and renovate them as well as part of the 400. So we're thinking that the combination of some of the larger or more expensive builds as well as some of the renovation builds, our average cost will be about $150,000 per unit.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, we're also hoping that we're going to be using land trusts on some of these. And as has been talked about in this committee last week, is certainly looking at manufactured homes as being one of the options of creating the home ownership opportunity. That's certainly allowable within this bill. So what we're really looking at is a variety of ways to create additional home ownership opportunities across our state. And we recognize that this is a challenge. This is a challenge for anybody that's developing any type of housing, whether it's rental or home ownership. But we think that this gives us a good chance to, as a pilot, and this is a pilot, the home bill is a pilot as it was passed in law, it gives us a chance to try out, trying to get have more of our population have the opportunity to get into home ownership.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom, I think we're going to send you to this course that these people are offering. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it with this. I think it's a laudable goal. I think that's some of what the private sector already does, and I guess I'm a little concerned that we would have the government. What if you build the house in you know, for what you got in it, you can't get out of it. We're kind of being speculators or developers in that sense. And so I'd like to learn a little bit more about it, but that's my final comment.
Would one of you two make an appointment to see him in his office, or both of you?
Yes, sir.
That would be great. Yes.
Okay, because it's actually, it's probably pretty simple, but at the same time, it sounds really complicated. So, okay.
Thank you.
All right, then, Senator Herr, if there's no more questions, we'll lay over Senate File 282 to for possible conclusion in the omnibus bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Member, for listening.
We're going to stray from the agenda just a little bit here, since Senator Rosen is here and she's not on the committee. We're going to have her come up and present her bill, Senate File 787.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anything to get out of Health and Human Services?
Well.
Health and Human Sacrifice.
I can keep you here longer if you want.
It's over with 11 or 1:30, if you could, please.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 787 is the Assistance to Entrepreneurial Development Bill. It continues the fine work of the Regional Center for Entrepreneurial Facilitation and the Small Business Development Center in the region. It about $360,000 is appropriated from the general fund for a grant to the Small Business Development Center hosted by Minnesota State University in Mankato with the help of the Regional Center for Entrepreneurial Facilitation. This direct assistance to small business would go into counties Blue Earth, Brown, Faribault, Le Sueur, Martin, Nicollet, Sibley, Wantonwan, and Waseca. The program has been built since 2007 and proven program to add jobs, value, create jobs, and help grow those businesses in that area. The program's unique with a collaborative approach, including federal, state, county, and local funding sources. And there's over 41 funding partners collaborate with this endeavor. It is continuously exceeding the goals set by the state. It's been praised by DEED for its grant administration excellence, and I believe it's even received a national award. There would be the commissioner would receive a report from the grant recipients by the first of every year, and of course the commissioner would report to the ranking chairs of the committees. With me, I have the executive director, Brian Stading, from the Regional Center for Entrepreneurial Facilitation, and Michael Nolan, the director of the Small Business Development Center at the Minnesota State University. I was going to say Mankato State University. Minnesota State University with me.
That's the same team that's ranked number one right now?
Go Mavs.
Who wants to go first? Just say your name for the record.
Michael Nolan, the director of the Small Business Development Center at Minnesota State University, Mankato.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much. So the Small Business Development Center and RCEF came together in this collaborative project a number of years ago. Before that, we were separate agencies with similar missions. We had a lot of dual redundancy in terms of grant administration expenses. And through the work of Representative Gunther, we were able to come together, which really enhanced the footprint of our collaborative nature of the two organizations. I also have with Brian Stading. Brian, do you want to
jump in now?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, my name is Brian Stadium, the Executive Director of the RCEF Office, the Regional Center for Entrepreneurial Facilitation in Mankato and in Fairmont. By partnering, the two organizations have established a well-defined area of service of excellence, leveraging federal dollars, county resources, and also encouraging local communities and banking partners. This collaboration has strengthened more small businesses, created more jobs, and helped businesses in accessing more capital than ever before. With continued and increased funding, we will expand our services to more communities, establish stronger local partnerships, and grow more businesses and jobs. Some of our pilot initiatives include programs to encourage students in their rural communities to conduct a comprehensive small business needs analysis. In addition, we will begin to build an export assistance center to help southern Minnesota businesses become more globally competitive. And I would allow Mike to expand a little bit on that.
Certainly. It's one of the more exciting initiatives. I just returned from Washington, D.C. last week, where our National Association of the Small Business Development Centers were meeting with our legislative group from Minnesota up there. Helping small businesses expand their exporting is an absolute priority in the state of Minnesota. We've worked closely with Kathleen Motzenbecker with the Minnesota Trade Office, as well as U.S. Commercial Service and the Small Business Administration to come together and develop the expertise to be that connecting person, to be able to roll up our sleeves and work inside the entrepreneur place of business, and to work with the trade assistance offices and those other agencies to help crease. Illinois has it, Iowa has it, Wisconsin has it, and the Dakotas have it. We do not have small business trade assistance offices at the local level. And so with this funding, we're going to begin to build that expertise and make those connections happen.
Do you want to continue, Mr. Stein?
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. I would just refer to page 2, just so that we are all on the same page. And we'll just briefly go through, for the sake of time, hours of consulting. Our goal was 3,500. The actual was 4,704. Number of clients was 350. The actual was 465. New businesses started, goal was 25, the actual was 35, capital 8 million, we actually exceeded up to 18 million, and jobs affected was 250, our actual was 656. I would make a note on there that the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development runs these numbers. So we do not track them. Well, we do track them, but they also track them. So there's a good audit trail, if you will, for that. I'll have Mike jump to page 3 real quick.
Sure. This is the Mike and Brian Roadshow. To best explain kind of what we do, so we're one of 900 small business centers in the United States. We operate under a federal grant by the Small Business Administration, which comes into Deed. Deed then allocates that out to 9 regional centers. So those 465 clients that came in our door, about 200 of those had a dream to start a business. About 100 of those actually realized within less than 5 hours that this wasn't going to be the right choice for them. And they either come back later or decide not to spend grandma's inheritance just yet. And we think that's a valuable service. But of those other 100 or so pre-ventures, those are the ones that started those 35 businesses in our region. And we're very, very proud of that. The other half of the equation are people who are in business. And these are people with businesses up to 500 employees in size. In reality, we generally tend to help 0 to 50 as kind of that small business in rural America. And of those, they come in for 3 reasons. They want to save their business, they want to grow their business, or it's time to sell the business. And we help each type of those. Most of the time, that requires getting some bank funding and some private equity. and that's where that $18 million figure comes in. So we work with private bankers. We also work with all the revolving loan funds in our region, Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, Region 9 Development, and all the county organizations. And I think Brian's big strength and really the collaborative effort here was Brian's organization is really grass-rooted in those community and county local area governments. So we've really been able to tie those in with in both Martin and Faribault County. We've also launched new initiatives in Waseca County, New Ulm, and Wantowan County, and we're working on Sibley County right now. So that's really what we're trying to do is establish these rural outposts.
I'd refer to page 3. And I think one of the strong components, and I'll just jump right to the bottom, we've never been able to assess the number of businesses that are still currently in business. We just never had the labor or the manpower to do that. We actually had a student do it. 92% of the clients that we've started are still in business after 5 years. So it's certainly a tribute to, again, kind of the grassroots approach. Day in and day out, we're working with business plans, marketing plans, really trying to either help them get a stable start and or help them understand that this may or may not be the time to start a business.
I think brevity is our friend here. I'll quickly go into everybody likes to make sure the money's being spent properly, and I have a lot of people who think they're our bosses, and they are. So first and foremost is the Small Business Administration, because we operate under their grant. They audit us, and they also have rules and procedures regarding budgets and how we can and cannot spend money. We office all our finance and grant administration is done by Minnesota State University, which has an incredible finance team. We passed a level 3 audit by the SBA just this past year with flying colors. Also, Deed administers our program, so they come down annually and review it. They also review all the monthly invoices and statement. And if that's not enough, we also have a national accreditation team that comes in every 3 years. So we I'm very proud of the fact that we've never had any findings in our region. I think we're very good grant administrators. Some of the new initiatives that we talked about, I think the Main Street initiative is one of the most exciting ones, and that was actually born in Brian's office.
You know, this is a real simple idea. The idea was to hire college students as they come back to their respective areas for summer employment, train them, develop a list of questions, and actually have them walk through the front door of every business in every town in all of our counties as far as our footprint is concerned. And our aspirations of this is going to be a more of a proactive approach than a reactive approach. We tend to really react. This is our only opportunity to take a proactive approach and actually make sure that we're addressing the needs and concerns of those existing businesses, as well as quickly getting a glimpse of any troubles that may be on the horizon. Equally, this will hopefully give those college students an idea of what's behind those doors. With all due respect, most of Southern Minnesota students tend to think that they need to come to the Twin Cities for that next glimpse of adventure.
We got that same problem up north.
So our hopes are is that as these students come back for summer jobs, we can put them to work. They actually will get to see what's on the other side of that door, possibly create some relationships. More importantly, it will give all of us data that we have never had before. And I think that data is going to be critical to moving all of our businesses forward, as well as making sure that our model is in line with their needs.
So do either of you know, is this part of the small business development grant, competitive grants that we have in the state? Are you?
Yes, I'm trying to count the years before. So for the past two legislative cycles, we've been in the competitive grant program. This past was at $280,000.
Okay.
So this would be moving us out of the competitive grant cycle and into a direct appropriation.
Okay. All right.
Yes, Senator Scoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so has the competitive grant ended?
The competitive grant ends on June 30th.
And
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, how, you, I think I heard you say there were nine other grantees in Minnesota?
There are nine small business development centers in the state of Minnesota, and so we're the South Central region. Each are housed at higher education.
Senator Scoy.
And Mr. Chair, and so the other eight, they're not here, so are they all just done at the end of this grant process?
I think only one, I strike that, I think two other SBDCs had applied for and received competitive grant funding. The SBDC as a total network is actually funded through deed, through a separate appropriation. But mostly it's federal dollars. We've been able to leverage more federal dollars because we have those local dollars. So
that's the Small Business Administration that you're talking
yes.
about. This is different than what Senator Scoy is talking about. So go ahead, Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman and members, the Small Business Development Grant Program is still in the base for about $1.4 million continuing in the next budget cycle. So, but it'll just be open up to new. The grants are only for 2 years.
But it would still be in the competitive grant situation.
Yes. The competitive grant program is still in the base budget.
But your particular one is expiring this year, and you would have to re-up it. This one would be directed to you directly.
Right.
That is correct.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask a similar question to Senator Scoy. I see Neighborhood Development Center in here. I see Twin Cities Rise. I see a number of organizations coming through for direct grant appropriations. So I guess I don't want to ask a premature question here, but I'm just wondering in my own mind how this committee intends to construct our budget or how you intend. You don't have to answer now, but...
Can't.
I guess Senator we need our target
not,
first.
Senator Cohen's not cooperating at all, just so you know. Okay.
But, you know, there are other organizations out there that have not dropped in their direct appropriations who are getting a little anxious.
Well, and that's something
they
want
to go through the competitive grant process, but if we're going to make direct appropriations to these organizations.
That's one of the things we'll have to decide. I think the governor's office wants to stick with the competitive grant process. Mm-hmm. I've never been enamored with it, but... some way, somehow, we have to make that decision, I guess, in this committee. So,
All right.
So,
everyone should be getting their bills in other words, pretty
fast. I think
fast.
They have.
Well, no, there are a number of organizations who are going to play by the rules and not go for their own separate slice of money.
Those can always change.
OMIDA is one that
well,
we haven't seen
yet. I would think that if we decided not to have the competitive grant process, mm-hmm. that at some point we would have to then start doing amendments to the bill to decide who's going to get the money. So,
all right.
Or potentially what we could do is what we tried to do in the last funding cycle was award to the money that the organizations got from the last competitive grant process and potentially include some others if we have extra money. But those are some of the options we could do. I have no idea what the House is thinking about, and I know where the governor's office wants to go, though. So.
All right.
Okay.
Great, thanks.
Is there any further testimony, Senator?
No, Mr. Chair, that is it. But this is a proven collaborative approach, and obviously we have results. And I hope that the other regions and areas can emulate something like this.
Let me just
it
ask
does work.
One question about the 92% of the clients mm-hmm. who started the business still. Is it a combination of the economy and what you do, or is it? Is there a way to answer it? Is why the success is so good, or is this a low number? Maybe this is a low number. I don't know. Maybe
it's much higher than the national numbers that you hear. You know, we turned one of our students loose, and basically, here's a list of all the businesses we helped get started in the past 5 years. And if you answer the phone, they're still in business. So it actually wasn't that tough a methodology. As to reason why. I think the type of entrepreneur that asks for assistance has kind of self-selected that they're more likely to succeed. It's not because we're wonderful. I think it's that type of entrepreneur. Also, these come through a very collaborative process. We are involved with 41 other agencies and bankers and communities that help fund and support and the work we do. So generally when they get launched, they're launched correctly, their books are in order, they've gone through financial training. I'm very proud of that success rate, and I think it's a combination of the preparedness that they have, and also the a little survivor bias. We're only surviving those that succeeded, and the ones who might have failed without this process weren't included in that. So very proud of that number.
Okay. All right, then if there's no further discussion or questions, then Senator Rosen will lay Senate File 787 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Is Senator Hayden's not here, right? So how about Senator Dietzick? You want to do your bill? As long as Senator Herr had one up for quite a while. Go ahead, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 487 requests funding for Twin Cities Rise to provide workforce skills training. Twin Cities Rise is a 20-year-old program started by an executive at General Mills who is concerned about growing numbers of unskilled workers who are not prepared to retain a job. This program is nationally recognized for its unique approach to working with chronically unemployed who have multiple barriers to employment success. The patented program offers emotional and intellectual support while participants develop the hard skills and soft skills that lead to permanent job placement. Twin Cities Rise is requesting in this bill $600,000 annually that is leveraged against an annual budget of $3.8 million. Twin Cities Rise tracks retention and is paid once a participant is placed in a job that pays an annual salary of at least $20,000 with benefits, and again after they remain on the job for 1 year. This is a true pay-per-performance model. If the individual doesn't make it in the program, the state is out nothing. Members, I have an A1 amendment. So it's an author's amendment. And I think they're handing out. So is what the amendment does is currently in statute there, 116J.8747 is a pay-for-performance model. And so is what we are doing is the base of the bill is still asking for Twin Cities Rise, and then we are also amending the statute to increase the numbers a little bit. Quite frankly, it somewhat addresses Senator Dibble's issue on that. If there is a, if there's not direct appropriation and if there are grants, then if somebody gets a grant here, this clarifies or increases the numbers that they're getting.
Senator Dietzick, is this the first committee you've been in?
Yep.
Okay, so this is an author's amendment then. So,
yep.
Senator Dietzick moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed motion adopted. Okay. Go ahead, Senator Dietzick.
Okay, with me today is Mr. Tom Streit, CEO of Twin Cities Rise, and I'll have him say a few words about the amendment and about the program.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Just say your name for the record and then go ahead.
Tom Streit, president of Twin Cities Rise. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be before your committee today. Once again, my name is Tom Streitz, president of Twin Cities Rise. Twin Cities Rise has a 20-year history of assisting those with multiple barriers to employment. Barriers include criminal history, chemical dependency. We help them train for and attain long-term employment with family-sustaining wages of $20,000 or more with benefits. We are a long-term intensive program that seeks to do more than just place an individual in any job, but rather our focus is on long-term income change. The average wage of a participant coming into our program in 2014 was approximately $3,000. And upon successful completion of the program, their income was approximately $26,000, over an 800% increase in wages. Our track record of results nationally and with the state of Minnesota is exceptional. We have a nation-leading 82% retention rate of employment after 1 year of employment for our graduates. The national average is 42%. We are exceptional proven value to the taxpayer. Twin Cities Rise pioneered pay for performance with the state of Minnesota over 18 years ago. The reason the statute exists, it was written because of Twin Cities Rise initiative and performance. For 16 years under the Minnesota state statute for pay for performance contract, Twin Cities Rise has returned $7 for every dollar invested in our program. Under our pay for performance model, Twin Cities Rise takes all the risk up front and only has to be paid by the state if we succeed. Twin Cities Rise privately fundraises over 80% of our budget to take this risk. This is tremendous leverage for the state. Our proposition to this committee and to the state is simple. We have a proven track record of performance and economic value to the taxpayer. pay us only if we perform. We have in place in the state the First in Nation pay-for-performance statute, referenced by Senator Dietzick. Let's continue our work together and get the long-term unemployed into jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments, Senator Gingrich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's quite an impressive number, the 80%. My question would be, I don't see any words on here. Maybe I'm missing it, but when they're coming to you with a $3,000 a year income and they're jumping up 80-some percent higher than that, can you show me where...
Can you hear him?
I'm sorry. It's a tad bit of a cold here. I'm sorry. Yeah. So when you have somebody coming in that has, I think you said, a $3,000 a year on the average income, and you bump them up to the income you're talking about here in excess of $20, are you showing... Obviously, there's going to be some savings showing. Have you got any numbers on that at all? Somebody coming in at $3,000 is probably doing something different, I mean, or expending some sort of resources, or some resources are being expended on them or their family, I would think. And do you show any of that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, we do have that information. Typically, that income is a result of maybe temporary employment or some sort of supplemental income. Some people come in with $1,000 or zero, some come in with $5,000, stitching together various low-income jobs. But we do track everything, and we know the incomes, and we have detailed records on where people have made money when they came in, where that source of income came from. We focus, you know, at the end of the day, it's what happens when they leave, and $27,000 last year was the average wage upon completion. And so that return on investment comes from those individuals are now paying taxes. They're not going back to jail. 67% of the participants in Twin Cities Rise last year had criminal histories or chemical dependency issues, DUIs, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So these are individuals who are really struggling to get back in the workforce, and we make it happen. And as I said, we only ask to get paid if we succeed, and we've been doing that for 18 years in the state of Minnesota with a great track record.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly my point. That is a very good track record. You should be commended for that. When you talk about people who are ex-offenders, if they go back and reoffend, there comes a heavy cost to that and a heavy cost to the taxpayers. So I'd love to see those numbers if I could. If you'd stop by with those numbers, that'd be just great. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay,
Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Then Senator Dietzick will lay over Senate File 487 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So, Senator Herb, you're Senate File 521. Go ahead. You go ahead up there. And Senator Hayden's bill is very similar, and the testifiers are the same two people. And so... I'm one of the co-authors of Senator Hayden's bill, so I think what we'll do here, Senator Herz, we'll have you present your bill, and then I'm going to have the two testifiers testify on both the bills at the same time, if you can. If Senator Hayden comes walking in, we'll have him join you at the table, okay. And you can give us the down and dirty of both bills at the same time. How's that sound? Okay? All right. Okay, so Senate File 538 and Senate File 521, Senator Herz.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Allow me to say a few things about NDC. NDC has been around for two decades now and have experienced recruiting and training, financing low-income entrepreneurs, including minority and immigrants wanting to start new businesses. As a result of that, today we have close to 500 small businesses employing more than 2,500 individuals. And contributed over $5 million in state incomes and sales taxes. Last year, NDC trained 86 individuals, provided 250 hours of technical assistance to business in my district. And I'm sure some of you, if you want to solve your data according to your district, NDC will have that available. Last week, I bumped into a gentleman, a business owner in my district, running an operation about $2 million and he revealed to me that he took a class with NDC back in 1996. That was surprising, and that's a good testimony of NDC's success. So I'm asking you to support this bill. This appropriation in this bill will support NDC business development activities and allow them to expand their service to suburban and rural communities as well. So with me is Mike Tamale and
Damon Johnson.
Damon Johnson.
So, Mr. Tamale, why don't you start out your testifying on Senate File 521, and I think you can go right into 538 at the same time if it's okay with you.
That'd
work?
Be great.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I almost forgot. I'd like to make an oral amendment to the bill.
Okay. On Senate File 521.
On line 1.8, right after Neighborhood Development Center, right after center, there's a period, and delete everything after that. You know, delete the part that said for the small business incubator program. Because this bill mainly talk about the request for general operation.
Okay. So on that motion, did everybody understand it? On line 1.8, put a period after the word center and delete the rest of the line. So all of the favors signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion is adopted. Okay. All right. Mr. Tamale.
So thank you very much, Senator Hurt and Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mike Tamale, Neighborhood Development Center CEO. The kind of work that we've been doing for 22 years now is very targeted into low-income inner city and suburban communities of color. So we have an entrepreneurial training and financing model that is highly targeted and designed to reach deep into these particular communities. We've trained over almost 5,000 people in a 20-week class to write a plan for their own business idea. So it's a business plan training class. We do this in five languages. We do it out in Eden Prairie and on the east side of St. Paul and a lot of places in between. When folks graduate from that class, they have a plan for their own business idea. Our next step then is financing. So we've put out almost $14 million of loans, some of which are from DEED, Urban Initiative Loan Fund, some of which are with SBA financing. We're a CDFI with the U.S. Treasury Department. We make loans anywhere from $250 up to $250,000. And we only finance folks that are not bankable. Okay, so if they can get a loan from a bank or even part of a loan from a bank, that's where they go, and we'll go with them. But we're in there to finance primarily people that can't do that yet in their trajectory of their business. So once we've financed these folks, we then provide what we call technical assistance or business consulting. We have a wide range of services from attorneys. Frederickson and Byron has provided us with hundreds of attorneys at no cost for the last 15 years. We have marketing experts, restaurant experts, graphic design and branding experts, et cetera. And so in that fashion, we find folks out in these communities. We partner with neighborhood groups or churches or whoever to connect with them. We train them. We finance them. We support them after they're in business. So it's a long-term comprehensive approach. Yet our cost per business created is about $25,000 programmatically, and our cost per job created is just under $5,000 per job. So we're pretty efficient in that fashion. And as Senator Hurst said, these businesses currently are returning about $5 million a year to the state of Minnesota through sales tax and state income tax. This model is now being replicated in a few other places around the country, most notably Detroit, where the Kellogg Foundation found it to be a very unique model to really reach into the immigrant communities, the African-American communities, the low-income white communities. So we've been up and running in Detroit for the last 3 years. We don't run it ourselves. We've trained a group there how to do that. Part of this bill would actually give us some, a little bit of this bill would be for us to have the capacity to train communities in Minnesota that are interested in this model, because when I've been here in the past, there's fairly often senators and representatives from greater Minnesota interested in how can we work there in their community. We don't pretend to know their economy or their networks and their players, but we certainly would love to sort of train them in our methodology, give them our training curriculum for the 20-week class, teach them how the financing works in conjunction with the training, et cetera. So that's 521. I've been joined by Senator Hayden to my right, your left, and he's authored a second bill with our name on it. Do you want to jump in on that?
Senator Hayden, you can quickly tell us what 538 does. It's very similar to 521, so we just thought we'd take them both at the same time since the testifiers are both the same also. So,
yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I was just in the healthcare committee presenting bills as well. It's that kind of day. Mr. Chair, 538 is the Small Business Incubator Initiative. I think Mr. Tamale has talked about the work that they do. They also have a great track record in terms of startup. Currently, NDC doesn't receive any state funds for the operation of the incubators. The bill would make capital improvements to the five existing incubators and establish an acquisition fund to assist the creation of new incubators. As he said, within the five sites, there's 129 businesses that employ over 750 people. Once again, they're responsible for $450,000 in income tax and $1.8 million in sales tax. So I think these business incubators have been successful. They're a great idea. It's the kind of thing that when we talk about small business, it's kind of the lifeline of our economy. I think that Mr. Tamale's organization is really showing that, especially in immigrant and African-American communities.
Okay, very good. Mr. Johnson, would you like to see if you can do both bills at the same time? Go ahead. Just say your name for the record, too, please.
Damon Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to testify on behalf of the NDC and talk about some of the help they've helped me with my business. I currently own Grooming House Barbershop with a co-owner. We actually have two locations. We just opened our second location about 2 months ago. The help that they've done, I've also done their entrepreneur program in the past, and they're actually currently helping me. We're starting our own nonprofit to help inner city youth to be groomed for greatness. We noticed that a lot of young men that come into our different locations have different issues and problems with understanding what it really takes to get into the workforce and just knowing how to present themselves. So they're actually helping us at this time get ready to start that off with hopefully a full launch within this when this next school year starts.
Okay. Are there any, Senator Ingebretson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a point of clarification. So in Senator Herr's bill, we took the Small Business Incubator Program out. Do we want to do the same here, or is it the same? It is different.
Who has an opinion on that? Because that's a good question.
There's no opinion, but Mr. Mike Tamale can explain it.
So the second one from Senator Hayden, that's specifically to provide some capital improvement money for our five of our six business incubators. And so that is about incubating businesses inside particular buildings, most of which are pretty old and need some help. And then a portion of that would be to start our next incubator project on the real estate side. So that is distinctly about incubators. The Senator Herr's bill is about our entrepreneur training and financing and technical assistance program. So that's why he pulled out the word incubator, because it's confusing in that sense.
Thank you.
Okay. So there are actually two different bills, which with separate sets of funding, which are going to separate places. So so there was a little bit of a misunderstanding by the chair, so I apologize for that. So okay. Is there any other questions or comments that anybody would like to make here? So okay, with that, then we'll lay over Senate File 521 and Senate File 538 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senate File 521 has amended. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I think that concludes the bill. So, Katie, you still here? Thank you for your patience.
Sure, no problem, Mr. Chair.
I figured you needed to know what was going on in the committee before you told us anything more. So
that's right.
Yeah, I wanted you to go last.
I learned a lot.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm Katie Topinka from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I'm here just to tell you all briefly about what the governor included in his supplemental budget for Minnesota Housing. You have a handout, has a red door in the upper left-hand corner. It says governor's budget changes. So the two things you've already heard about on this handout were the $2.5 million for bridges, which is rental assistance for households in which at least one adult member has a mental illness. And then you also heard about, from the commissioner, $250,000 for capacity building to support the homeless management information system, and that's a system that we're required to have by the federal government, where we enter data on homelessness, and we use it to secure federal funding for homelessness. So I'm not going to go into those. Those were in the governor's original budget proposal. The two new items are $10 million for the Housing and Job Growth Initiative, and then $2 million for the Rental Assistance for Highly Mobile Students Initiative. These should be somewhat familiar to the committee. They are both initiatives that were in the 2014-15 budget, and the governor has put them in again this time around to extend these new programs. The Housing and Job Growth Initiative is... It was developed in response to concerns from communities, particularly in greater Minnesota, where employers would like to expand, but there's not enough housing to meet the needs of the local workforce. I know this committee has already heard a lot about that, so I won't describe the problem anymore, but I'll tell you a little bit about this initiative. It is an initiative that's part of the agency's Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, or the Challenge Fund. And the Challenge Program was established in 1999 and was designed to address workforce housing needs around the state. And it really allows communities to identify their unique needs and then apply for funding to Minnesota Housing to address those needs. So it can be used for traditional multifamily rental housing, one- and two-bedroom units, or for single-family housing for home ownership, or for townhomes for rent, whatever the communities really identify as their need. The challenge program and under this initiative, there are income limits, but they are one of the higher income limits we have with our programs. It's 80% of statewide median income for rental housing and 115% of statewide median income for homeownership. So in greater Minnesota, this translates to $62,000 per year as the annual household income for rental and $89,000 per year for homeownership. And Minnesota Housing recently examined deed data looking at communities around the state that you've heard a lot about, where there are employers looking to hire. And we found that more than 90% of the new hires in these communities have wages that fall below the challenge program income limits. So we think this program really can address a lot of the needs you've heard about in committee already. So just really briefly go over what we did with the initiative in the previous 2 years. You have another handout that says workforce housing on top. And there's a chart on the back that shows you all the selections we made through the first round of the Housing and Job Growth Initiative. So you can see it's pretty well distributed around the state. There were 10 projects in greater Minnesota and 3 in the metro area. 63% of the funds went to greater Minnesota and 37% went to the metro area. And this chart represents a mix of both rental and homeownership activities. And we really worked closely with communities around the state to have them bring applications for funding to us. We've hosted a number of meetings that we call housing and community dialogues around the state to really understand needs in certain areas. We had one in Chisholm in November. The chair was there. And we have one in Appleton next week.
We still didn't get any money. Okay, go ahead.
Well, you did through the publicly owned housing program awards. We made it.
All right. Okay.
And as you can see through the list here, these were funds we awarded to projects in Roseau, Thief River Falls, Jackson, Duluth. These were selections we made in both 2013 and 2014. This is, to receive funding under the initiative, communities had to have a cooperatively developed housing plan, have low vacancy rates, and have experienced job growth, can document future job growth, or have a significant portion of area employees who commute more than 30 miles to work. And we really want communities to identify whether they meet these criteria. And then the other piece of it, the challenge in the challenge program, is really to challenge employers to make contributions toward housing. And so this shows a commitment from the employer that they're committed to being in that community, and it reduces the amount of money required from the state that's needed for these developments. So we were able to get employer contributions in 1/3 of the projects that were funded under this initiative, and employers can really identified a variety of ways that they can make investments. So it could be direct cash, they could purchase federal tax credits, they could invest in a loan pool, so they could donate land. So there are really a variety of ways they could be involved. So we think this is a proven and flexible tool that communities can use to meet their unique housing needs. So that's the first initiative that the governor included in the supplemental. Again, it would be to expand the work that has been done over the past 2 years.
Who applies for the money? Is it the cities? Is it the HRAs? Is it the community action agencies? Who does the applications for the money?
Mr. Chair, it can be all of the above, really. Typically, it's private developers, some for-profit and some nonprofit developers. But we do receive some funding from HRAs. So if you look at the chart here, you can see that Northwest Community Action of Roseau received an award. The Tamarack Place development is through a private developer, Sand Companies. There's the Workforce Housing Partnership is the last thing on the list for Worthington and Jackson. That's the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership. So they're a nonprofit developer. So it can be a variety of organizations.
Okay.
So the second item that the governor included is the Rental Assistance for Highly Mobile Students program. This, again, was funded the first time in the current biennium that we're in, and the governor has proposed $2 million to continue this pilot. Under the initiative, homeless or highly mobile families with school-aged children receive rental assistance, and we know that achievement gaps for homeless students emerge early and persist often. For example, 61% of all fifth graders in Minnesota were proficient in math in the 2013-14 school year. But if you compare that to homeless students, only 24% were proficient. So homelessness or mobility within housing really can impact school performance. So the goal of this initiative is to provide housing stability to families so that the school attendance and hopefully ultimately school performance will improve. We're currently working with three administrators for the pilot. The Wilder Foundation is working with students in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. Project for Pride and Living is working with families in the Northside Achievement Zone in Minneapolis, and then Clay County is working with students in the Moorhead Public School District. We're working closely with the Department of Education to evaluate the program and see the results, and we'll continue to work closely with them if this is funded again.
And how do these people get the money?
So the money is provided to the nonprofit rental assistance administrators, so like the Wilder Foundation, for example. And then the nonprofit works directly with the school district to identify families who are eligible, and then the rental assistance administrators provide the funding to the families directly for housing. We're still assembling the data on this, but one current participant has shared that the stability she received through the rental assistance has allowed her to work toward her associate's degree, and that it has had positive effects on her children's attendance and has reduced their overall household stress. Just having that housing stability has made that difference in their lives.
Does the highly mobile student or highly mobile family, how do they know that this assistance is available?
Mr. Chair, the rental assistance administrators get the funding, and then they are working directly with the schools, so the schools will notify the families. So the schools keep track of who the homeless and highly mobile families are. It's something they already do. So the schools identify the families and connect them with the rental assistance administrators.
So this is connected with the low-income people that are already declaring it at the school? Is that how they do it? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So that's really it. Those are the two new pieces that the governor included in his supplemental for us. There is a chart on this first handout I referred you to that has all of our budget items and includes the governor's new recommendations. And if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to take them. But otherwise, we hope for the committee's support on these.
Okay. Any comments or questions? Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the update.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Great. With that, the meeting is adjourned.